Hello, welcome to the Law Report. I'm Erica Vowles. I want you to imagine for a moment that your professional work touches on some pretty difficult and dark stuff. So child abuse, murder, neglect, and intractable mental health problems. How do you think you'd cope with this load? Would you binge on escapist TV shows? Maybe occasionally drink too much? What about turning your work into fiction? Anne Buist is a perinatal psychiatrist. She's the chair of women's mental health at Melbourne University. She works with protective services and is an expert witness in the legal system in cases of abuse, kidnapping, infanticide, and murder. And she's also an author. Her first novel, called Medea's Curse, looks at infanticide and introduces forensic psychiatrist Natalie King. Anne's latest novel is called This I Would Kill For. And it's worth noting that today's discussion with Anne contains some pretty challenging content and it's unsuitable for young children. Thanks for joining me, Anne.
Thank you, Erica. Great to be here.
So this is your third novel featuring the character Natalie King, a forensic psychiatrist. Introduce me to Natalie. What's she like?
Natalie's young, very passionate about her patients. She works pretty much only with women at the edge of the forensic system with sort of 0 to 3 year olds in the perinatal period, which is really what I do as well. I guess the other aspect to Natalie is she's got a very complicated private life, which sort of mirrors her coming to terms with her own issues and things that she needs to grapple with, which is she's been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. So she's got a few challenges in her life.
Well, as many of us do. So when did Natalie King walk into your life, into your head, and why did you decide to work with her fictionally to explore these dark subject matters that you deal with in your real life?
So look, it started pretty much back probably 20 years ago, though not with Natalie per se, when I was asked to give some expert opinion to the media, and it was a case where the little boy had been killed by the de facto partner of the mother. And I said this was a terrible tragedy and we needed to work at understanding why these happened in order to prevent. And I got hate mail and I thought, whoa, I wasn't excusing this man. But it really opened my eyes to the fact that people have a very black and white view of this area. We need to protect our children, and that gets people very emotional when things go terribly, terribly wrong. But in the cases that I've been dealing with and since, is there rarely black and white, and rarely just simply good and bad. And it's that grey area that as psychiatrists we find a narrative for to make sense of what happened. Not necessarily excuse, but make sense of, and certainly be able to help that person, but also look at prevention. So then in 2011, when I walked the Camino de Santiago, I had a literary epiphany and decided life was too short to work these really long hours and I was going to take some time off and go back and do some fiction. And though I started Medea's Curse as non-fiction, I very quickly thought actually fiction enables me to write it in a much, much more satisfying way, because you can see all of the aspects and from a reader's point of view, finish some of those off and make sense of them for everyone.
So fill in the blanks when, if you're talking about real life cases, there's things you can't talk about and you want to protect people's privacy, those kinds of things.
Absolutely. And as a psychiatrist, I didn't really want to traumatise my patients by revamping their cases again and again and again.
The book is called This I Would Kill For. And you explore the issue of child abuse, and Natalie King is trying to work out if an 8-year-old girl, Chelsea, is being abused, and if so, by whom. Why did you want to explore this story in fiction?
I guess I do a lot of child abuse cases. Unlike infanticide, which fortunately is quite rare, child abuse is very common. We have about 12,000 in Victoria, 120 or so around the nation each year, substantiated. So we're talking about something that's very common, and there's a lot beyond that. And usually the sexual abuse cases don't come up until they're adults. So we're missing a lot. And I really wanted to sort of look at these impacts, and in some of the cases that I'd been seeing, in my mind, I started to think about, you know, how much can I do as a psychiatrist? I'm not a detective. I give Natalie a little bit more detective power than I have. And I have the same argument within myself that Natalie has with Liam. And Natalie kind of says, you know, I've got to make the right decision. And Liam, who's the prosecutor, says, No, it's the judge that makes the decision. But she rightly, I think, says, how can the judge make the right decision without the right information being given? Judges or magistrates rely on expert witnesses, unbiased witnesses that are giving the whole story as much as they can.
And so you're trying to explore, or you're exploring in fiction, some of the stuff that you grapple with in your real life cases, but in your work with protective services, is it often much more obvious, much more straightforward who the perpetrators are? Or do you also go through this situation of trying to work out?
Look, there's certainly a number where the either is it happening? There's one I'm currently involved with, whether is it happening at all? And I'm not a paediatrician, so they're fighting that out as well. But there's some real psychiatric components to this particular case where I do have to sort of say, well, this is the most likely scenario, and a child psychiatrist will have to have their say as well. It's a very complicated case. But I've been involved in other ones where the child has been shaken, fractured bones, bruises, and no one is saying they did it. And when it comes down to it had to be either the mother or the father, they start off saying, no, it wasn't either of us, and almost invariably end up saying it was them. And they separate, and then there's this really a custody battle like this one with the couple against each other and with protective services potentially saying, I don't want either of them to have the child.
How do you get to the truth in that situation?
I don't know that you do all the time. Certainly as psychiatrists, we can't read minds. We can do a balance of probabilities. And certainly if there's a mental illness involved, then that adds an extra complexity. But quite often it's much more personality, poor role models, maybe some drugs have been involved as well. And it's not simple.
We're in a very interesting time in Australia. We've been through the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Abuse. And I can't think of another time in our history when there's been so much focus on these kind of acts against children. This forms the backdrop of your novel. Why did you want to explore this in fiction?
Well, interesting, the backstory of Chelsea and whether or not she's been abused, I really wrote as a book called Kate and Kathy 20 years ago. And so I revamped it for this in a slightly different format. And it really fitted in with both the Royal Commission and the experience of what's going on. But it gave me a chance to look at the here and now, the sort of what parents, the sort of emotions that come up with parents when their custody issues, when there are sexual abuse claims come up, and hopefully really kind of help people deepen the level of understanding that the media reports and the Royal Commission is kind of a process that has been started, but I don't think finished.
And you've been working in this field for some time now. Do you feel that the Royal Commission on Child Sex Abuse has been a watershed moment in getting people to appreciate just how damaging and corrosive child sexual abuse can be?
Look, I think it's been a necessary thing. I think there's been negatives with it and re-traumatising people. But for some of those people, it has been cathartic. But I just look at sort of what my parents' generation thought and felt, and they kind of often knew, oh, yeah, you don't let your child anywhere near that teacher, that priest, that whatever, but never actually did anything. And I think it's because they really, really didn't understand the level of psychological impact it had. I think still there's a lot to be grappled with that, with emotional abuse in families. A lot of the families I see that aren't sexually abusing their children aren't necessarily physically abusing their children, but the emotional abuse and neglect leaves an incredible scar.
So Chelsea's actual case, she's an 8-year-old girl, she's being abused by someone she knows. So do you think there's enough understanding that a child abuser is likely to be known to a child, not necessarily a father, but, you know, a male relative, a family friend, a neighbour, someone in a child's periphery?
Yeah, look, I think it almost always is. Very, very rarely a stranger. Neighbours and friends, brothers and fathers are kind of certainly all in the mix. You know, I have a group of mums that I, with postnatal depression, that themselves have been sexually abused, and part of their anxiety about being a perfect parent is protecting their children. And it's how you help them be relaxed around the men that are safe, because not all men are abusers. And it's absolutely imperative to understand that there are some fabulous fathers and grandfathers and teachers, and but as a parent, you really do need to protect your child and make an assessment of that risk.
As a parent of two daughters, it's an impossible juggling act that you do, and you just try and approach it. I try and approach it from a risk management perspective. Natalie King, so she's an expert witness. She's been tasked by the magistrate to investigate Chelsea's family, work out if the child's being abused, if so, by whom. Can you tell me how Natalie grapples with this enormous responsibility of trying to work out what's going on?
Well, there's a couple of paragraphs where she's speaking to her supervisor, Declan, who's a psychotherapist, psychiatrist, and she kind of says, you know, can't we just err on the side of caution? Let's just give custody to the mum. To which Declan responds, what about the younger brother, who is the biological child of Malik, who's the father, and what would you be doing to him if he didn't do this? And her, as it happens, because they have a he has been the only father she's ever known, and father figures have a really important role to play in children's lives. And so what message do you give if you're taking that away? And not just for this man, but for stepfathers, adoptive fathers, foster fathers. So it's about justice, being fair, but also being safe. And that's a really, really tough call.
Is it that Natalie, as a psychiatrist and also yourself, you're one piece of the puzzle?
Yes, I mean, Natalie feels she's more than one piece, but that's because that's part of her character. I mean, the reality is, you know, protective services obviously have a huge role. There are often other psychiatrists or other health professionals involved as part of the putting this puzzle together.
This is The Law Report, and I'm Erica Vowles, and my guest today is psychiatrist and novelist Anne Buist, and she's also the chair of women's mental health at the University of Melbourne. You wear a lot of hats, Anne. And I'd like you to read a passage from your book where Natalie King is in the witness stand, and the court's trying to work out what's happening with 8-year-old Chelsea. And she's actually just started asking questions about how you get pregnant. And it's a pretty intense scene. In the courtroom, we've got Chelsea's mum, Jenna Radford. We've got Chelsea's dad, Malik Essa, lawyers for both parents, as well as the protective services lawyer, Harvey Alcock, who's questioning Natalie King.
What do you make of Mrs. Radford's statement regarding the child's mention of pregnancy? Without assessing Chelsea, it's hard to say, said Natalie slowly. It may have been brought up at school. She may have become upset because of her mother's anxiety. But it rings an alarm bell, loud enough for it to be worth investigating. And definitely worth checking out the teacher's observations. And would this abuse, he caught Pam's expression, were it happening, be disruptive for a 3-year-old boy as well? Yes. And would he find it destabilising to see his father without his sister present? He might. It's true, isn't it, Dr. King, that children are more at risk of sexual abuse from stepfathers, more so than from natural fathers? Objection, Pam. Dr. King is not a policewoman or a criminologist. Bad call, thought Natalie. The evidence was nowhere near as strong as people generally supposed. Her answer would have helped Malik. The magistrate frowned. I don't think this line of questioning is taking us anywhere. Do you have anything more, Miss Delcock? The protective services lawyer paused, walked to one end of the courtroom, then paced back to Natalie. Not for drama, but thinking time, Natalie thought. What about culture, Dr. King? How do you think Mr. S's upbringing will impact on his parenting of a young girl alone? Natalie felt she was walking a tightrope over a volcano. I don't know anything about Mr. S's upbringing. Alcock's smile was forced. But the child's mother has expressed concerns to us that Mr. Essa belittles her, follows her, checks her phone records, possessive, patriarchal, you might say. Is this the sort of culture you want your daughter exposed to? I can only reiterate that I haven't assessed Mr. Essa. But you've assessed Ms. Radford and the children will be safe with her. Yes. Careful. I believe so. Chris is my son. Malik was out of the chair again. Two security men appeared at the door. Sit down, Mr. Essa. I won't tell you again, said the magistrate. Malik gave into his lawyer's arm tugging, and Alcock also sat down. I'm finished, Your Honour.
And that's a reading by author and psychiatrist Anne Buist from her latest novel, This I Would Kill For. Natalie, in this passage, she's in the witness box, and it's painted as a pretty intense place, and she's got a really complicated juggling act to perform as a witness. Is that what it's like in reality?
Look, it is, and this is the court I'm in most of the time. The children's court's a really interesting court, and it's the children's court clinic, which kind of gets me to see these cases, have this really, you know, challenging task of helping paint the picture for the court. And it's particularly challenging because you do have, like in this case, at least three lawyers. I've had four. In one particular case, I had the grandfather acting for himself because he was a lawyer. So there were five, I think. So lots of lawyers in a really small room. As happens in one of the court cases, in this I would kill four, there's a QC. That actually happened in real life. It does happen. It's unusual, but it does happen. And it can drag on.
And you appear in cases as an expert witness around potential child abuse and cases involving infanticide. This is something I think as a society we really struggle to come to grips with. What do you think is the most misunderstood aspect of infanticide, a mother killing their baby?
I think there's a tendency to think they're bad, that it's such a terrible thing. And it is. It's babies, and particularly human babies, are incredibly vulnerable. We're not like foals and calves that can stand up and chase our food source. Human babies are incredibly vulnerable, right through to the lack of neck muscles and all of the issues we've had with shaken baby, and just through, you know, parents perhaps, you know, in a moment of anger. And understanding a moment of anger, is that all it is? I think mostly the public tend to think bad. And we've had a couple of very high profile cases in Victoria where I think particularly of concern is the age sometimes of the child, because Victorian infanticide law, you're allowed to plead infanticide up to 2 years. And there is a lot of kind of angst, I think, about why can women use that? Because it has to be the biological mother, and that's the way the law is written. Mind, state of mind is altered by the act of giving birth or lactating. And it's not always as biological as that implies. And so it's very complicated, and it's easier to think bad. And I think that's what we thought, or a lot of the public thought, with Robert Farquharson, and Helen Garner in her book House of Grief kind of really tries to tease it out. And in her most recent book, Everywhere I Look, she talks about how she wouldn't have been interested writing House of Grief if he'd just been a monster. Because what is it? And I don't work with monsters. That is not who I'm seeing. I've yet to see a woman who is a psychopath and did it purely because she was bad and evil. Not saying they don't exist, and certainly there have been some revenge killings where women have killed children, largely revenge as being part of the motive, at least. But they're not the ones I see.
And you mentioned Farquharson, and I believe this is the father who killed his children.
Yeah, drove the three children into the dam.
This is the Law Report on Radio National, News Radio and Radio Australia. You can also listen to us on your smart device, and if you're looking for other Law Report programs, you can go to our homepage. You can also check out the ABC Listen app for the Law Report and other shows. I'm Erica Vowles. Today we're talking with perinatal psychiatrist Anne Buist. She's the chair of women's mental health at Melbourne University. She works in protective services and is an expert witness in the legal system, and she's an author. Her latest novel is called This I Would Kill For, and a reminder that today's discussion with Anne contains some pretty challenging content, and it's unsuitable for young children. So the title of your book is This I Would Kill For, and I guess that's the idea of any parent who found out that their child had been abused. The urge to bring about retribution would be strong, but obviously that's what a parent shouldn't do because their child is going to need them. What's the title mean for you?
It's about the passion that child custody and potential child abuse by the other partner brings up. I don't think there is anything that stirs our passion as much. And in many ways, I tap back into when I had about a 10-year-old girl, and there was a case, I think it was up in Bendigo, where a little girl was sexually abused and then thrown in a dam. And the man led people and said she was pleading for her life as I threw her in. And if I'd had a gun at that point in time, I really think I would have killed the man. I mean, it was just, I was so enraged. Now, I don't believe in murder and I don't believe in guns, so I hope that wouldn't happen. But I can understand why we would do this. It's just, and I have a daughter. I have a son too. I'd kill for him as well. It's such a powerful thing. And I might add, I say that I don't work with monsters, but that was a monster.
More than a decade ago, you appeared as an expert witness in the trial of a 17-year-old high school student from Ballarat. She hid her pregnancy, she gave birth at home, and then she killed a child. Explain to us, how do you as a psychiatrist make sense of this situation happening in this perinatal period?
And this is another one that Helen Garner has written about. Look, I've now seen quite a number of these, probably about eight, and they're always associated with denial of pregnancy. So they're called neonaticides because they're killed within 24 hours of delivery. And in fact, a statistician calculated that our biggest chance of being murdered is in our first day of life. The only exception to that, interestingly, is in one country of the world, and it's America, and it's if you're a black man between 20 and 35. Mm. But everywhere else in the world, it's your first day of your life. Now, it's still a really rare occurrence, thank goodness. But these neonaticides, so I've seen at least, say, eight, no one knew they were pregnant. The mothers don't know they're pregnant. They've been able to hide it. The famous Kelly Lane case, the water polo player, she played polo. Her partner, who was having intimate relationships with her, didn't know it. So they've managed to hide this, which kind of anyone who's been pregnant thinks, whoa. Many of these girls continue to have periods, continue to spot, and that kind of fed into this denial. Almost all of them were not very well educated. Even if their age in some cases were in their 20s, they were intellectually or maturity-wise more around 12. Basically, what I was feeling I was seeing in all of these cases was a 12-year-old who'd suddenly given birth. And I challenge anyone who's had a much-wanted, loved baby to then think, pretend you're 12, you don't know anything much about sex, you kind of got a vague idea, and suddenly you've got these incredible pains and something falls out of you. Mm. They panic. If the baby dies, and they don't always die, three of those cases I saw the baby survived and in one case went home with the mother.
Which, if this is something that's a temporary state of insanity, then that's got to be a good result.
Yeah, look, some of them dissociate, so they kind of separate out of their bodies, essentially looking down on themselves, blanket out. Some of those denials have been incredibly powerful. About half of these cases have significant abuse histories, so that kind of feeds into this sort of ability to step out of their space. And they're often very emotionally cut off from this. These are not women who have gone through the pregnancy, planning it, thinking about it, dreaming of a baby. They're cut off emotionally and they remain cut off quite often.
Another case, I just want you to mention it briefly if you can, in Victoria involving a young woman, Sophina Nikat. She initially blamed the disappearance of her baby on a man of African appearance. Then she confessed to smothering her child. She was suffering from depression. She'd been living in a women's shelter at the time. I believe that you not only wrote a report in this case, but you consulted with the prosecution psychiatrist before the court heard the evidence.
Yeah.
What was that like?
I can't talk about what we resolved, but mm-hmm. I thought it was a really interesting process and I thought a very inspired judge, because you can waste a lot of court time interviewing psychiatrists. It was much better having the two of us sit down and say, what do we agree on and what don't we agree on, which is really what the process was about. And I was primarily a perinatal psychiatrist with forensic as my second kind of arrow or whatever, whereas she was primarily a forensic psychiatrist. So we had different points of view coming to the case, but we both trained as psychiatrists. We both understood the same language. So in fact, we were able to come out with a report, which I think probably made it a lot easier for the judge to make sense of what we were trying to say. And I think it was really quite inspired idea on his part.
Because, you know, they're legal experts, but they're not psychiatrists.
Exactly. And we were trying to sort of, you know, make sense of our words in legal terms. And when I asked the lawyer, how should I word this? They said, look, leave the legal terms to us. You just do it as best you can in lay terms and let us put it into the legalese, which I was very grateful for.
You also, as we've mentioned, appear as an expert witness in cases of child abuse, situation where there's evidence of abuse. This is a tough area for you to work in because I guess on the one hand, you're trying to determine who has committed the abuse. Is the child still at risk? But on the other hand, I mean, the reality is if a child is going to be put in out-of-home care in Victoria and around Australia, the out-of-home care system is stretched.
Absolutely, and not without risks. And there was one particular case, it was actually a New South Wales case, where I actually gave the statistics of I was advising them giving the child back to the parents. They'd come and removed it at delivery. And these were very much loving parents whose mental illnesses were well treated. And I actually gave the statistics. If you put this child in and out of foster care, these are the damages that are going to occur. If you could adopt a child out at birth or early on, that's a different scenario. But most of these cases, that's not what happens. We would be better focusing our money and attention on supporting these parents or the ones that we think that can make it with support.
I think $1 in $5 in this system is spent on prevention. Mm-hmm. Do we have the balance right here?
I don't think so. And I think getting in early, pregnancy and that first postnatal year is the really chance where even women who have been abusing drugs, who have had a terrible childhood, this is the one time they will really, really focus on trying to be the best mother they can.
In your fictional work, writing about forensic psychiatrist Natalie King, and in your real life, you know, I know you're doing more writing now than psychiatry, but you still are dealing with incredibly dark subject matters. How do you keep your mental state healthy so that you can contribute and support the system that tries to keep everyone safe?
Well, I think not taking work home with you and not working 12-hour days is really important. And I guess the beauty of fiction is, and even in Medea's Curse, which was about infanticide, I was able to give some uplifting components to some of my characters, resolve their stories. And I think there's a lot of satisfaction in doing that, which I can't do in real life. And I also like walking a lot. I do lots of long walks and wrote a feel-good book written on the Camino de Santiago, Two Steps Forward. So that was a nice kind of way of balancing out some of the darker stuff.
Anne Buse, thank you so much for joining us and for speaking to The Law Report.
Thank you, Erica. Pleasure.
Anne Buse is a psychiatrist, the chair of women's mental health at Melbourne University, and she's an author. And she's just published her latest novel featuring forensic psychiatrist Natalie King. It's called This I Would Kill For, and it's published by Text. That's it for The Law Report. Anita Barrow is the show's producer. Big thank you to you, Anita, for all your help. And also, the sound engineer this week is Ari Gross. Big thanks to you too. I'm Erica Vowles. Catch you next time.